a law modelled on Putin's Russia, a kleptocratic regime in the pockets of Putin, but a flowering of resistance and mass protests on the streets. Today we find out what's happening in Georgia and what it symbolises about the new imperialism engulfing our world.
Tens of thousands of people are marching through the streets in Georgia's capital tonight, protesting a new law that critics say threatens free speech. The bill would target some media and non-profit organisations to register as pursuing the interests of a foreign power if they receive foreign funding.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Our guest on today's show is Alex Scrivener. He's the director of the Democratic Security Institute, a think tank based in Tbilisi, Georgia. He's also an old friend of the Another Europe is Possible family, all the way back in the 2016 EU referendum. More recently, Alex has worked with the Another Europe Network on building international solidarity with Ukraine's freedom struggle. Today we ask Alex about what's happening in Georgia and why the world, and especially its progressive democratic forces, shouldn't stand idly by as its democracy comes under real threat.
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anothereurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
So Alex, welcome to the show. How's things going with you? Old comrade from the EU referendum 2016. The battle of all battles. You've now found a new scrape to get involved in.
Well, it's arguably, I mean, it might not even be a new scrape, actually. I mean, yeah, it's been very tiring last few weeks, to put it lightly. I mean, it feels like 8 years ago, you and I were out in the streets, fighting tooth and nail against a far-right, Putin-backed attempt to get our country out of the EU. And here I am, 8 years later, out in the streets, fighting tooth and nail against a far-right, Putin-backed scheme to get my country out of the EU, or keep it out of the EU in this case, rather than leaving. So it feels like I'm in not a very different place from where I was 8 years ago, and it's all very tiring.
Yeah.
You have to explain this as if to a complete novice, which is what I am. Who are the Georgian government and what do they believe in and what are they trying to do?
Well, this Georgian government, it's run by a party called the Georgian Dream Party, who have been in power here since 2012. They're run by this very shady, reclusive oligarch whose net worth is about a quarter to a third of the entire country's GDP, called Bidzina Ivanishvili. So he founded this and effectively controls the country from backstage. He doesn't have an official state title, but basically controls that political party. He and his party have been in power for that amount of time. But as for what they believe in, what they want is to stay in power at all costs. And that's also what they believe in. I mean, they don't really believe in anything at all. And it's kind of a feature, actually, of politics in this part of the world, is the ideology and sort of conviction politics isn't a very major part of how politics works here. It's all very sort of network-based and money-based. So, you know, when I go back to the UK, it feels almost sort of quaint sometimes that, you know, people here actually care about ideology and what kind of policy to have. Whereas here, it feels like the same politician who might be pro-Western 10 years later might be effectively be pro-Russian purely because their personal interests change. So, yeah, in terms of what they want, I mean, at the moment, they're absolutely pushing a line that favours effectively the Kremlin's interests. But they were elected back in 2020 under a completely different prime minister who was elected under a mandate to be pro-EU and join the European Union. And in fact, just last year, Georgia gained candidate status to join the European Union. So it's a very shifting position that this political party has had. But at the moment, yes, the reason for these protests is because they're currently pushing this line that will effectively prevent Georgia from joining the EU.
Yeah, so could you tell us a bit more about the foreign agents law? There's been a bit of discussion around this in the internet community, I guess the online community that you're engaging with. I've seen you post about it on Twitter and whatnot, some of the reactions from the how can you call it generously, like the international leftosphere, saying, well, what's wrong with like NGOs that receive foreign funding having to declare their foreign funding on a register. How would you respond to that argument? And could you tell us a bit more about the foreign agents law?
So the foreign agents law is, and it's called here colloquially the Russian law, and there's a reason for that. It was first adopted in Russia back in 2012 as a model that's now being rolled out to a whole series of other countries, not just Georgia, actually. Kyrgyzstan as well in Central Asia, being mooted to be an option for Robert Fico's Slovakia. It's already in force in Hungary under Viktor Orban. So it's a sort of franchise model where, you know, the law is getting rolled out. But originally the original iteration is the Russian version, which basically says that if you get any money from abroad, if your organization, your NGO, your charity or whatever gets any money from abroad, over 20% of income, then you have to register as an agent of foreign influence. Effectively, you're saying that, you know, we're not really defending the interests of people here in Georgia, but we're being dictated to by some shady foreign power. And if you if there's either a problem with the submission or you refuse to submit, then there are huge fines that can be brought to bear, which would effectively bankrupt most small organizations. And this law has united effectively the entire country, a large proportion of the country anyway, because 80% of people here support joining the EU. And this law has been recognized not just by the EU itself, but by the very technocratic Council of Europe Venice Commission as being basically not compatible with not just EU membership, but with sort of basically democratic society. The reaction, as you've alluded to, from some parts of the Western left, is that, well, so what? Just go and register and call yourself a foreign agent and continue working as if that's the easiest thing in the world. And the problem with that argument is that this law is just the thin end of the wedge. We saw what happened in russia after they passed their version. Effectively, first you have to declare yourself a foreign agent, and then immediately afterwards comes additional legislation that says, well, if you're a foreign agent and you're actually a traitor to the country, then you shouldn't be allowed to do the following activities. And most of those activities end up being political, for example, observing elections or participating in Georgian politics in a kind of hands-on way. So eventually you end up being kind of muscled out and shut down. And effectively, you end up in a situation where the government has a monopoly over the civil society sector. The thing is, in Georgia, because we're a very small country, it's a very poor country, basically every single NGO or charity is funded from abroad. There's no situation like in the UK where there's a kind of class of relatively wealthy people who are able to, you know, sponsor or donate to organizations. And it's not really a culture of crowdfunding in quite the same way as there is in the West. So effectively, if you are a small organization like mine or like basically every other organization in Georgia, you are dependent to some extent on foreign grant money to keep you going. There's just no other way. So effectively, this is tarring the entire Georgian civil society sector with the brush of being a foreign agent. So everyone from like a small organization in rural Georgia supporting women's healthcare to an organization that like mine, which is a think tank, a small think tank, or two big advocacy organizations who work in political issues. All of us effectively are affected by this law.
So you're a foreign agent, right?
I will be, yes. No, it won't be actually, because I refuse to, like all of us in the, like quite a lot of us in the sector anyway, we have vowed to resist this law. We are not going to register. We're not going to call ourselves foreign agents. We're going to find ways. Some of the bigger organizations are just going to ignore it and just resist and wait for the police to come knocking on the door and resist that way. For small organizations like ours, we're looking at sort of ways to circumvent the legislation. So for example, in the case of my organization, it's likely we'll try and register abroad and continue our activity with our legal legislation not being based in Georgia. But that's a stopgap measure. Eventually, if this government, and it's openly said this is the reason behind this law, is acting to gain political control and oppress resistance and from civil society, then everything we do legally is just a way to win time. And that's why it's of existential importance that we in Georgia resist this law and maintain the basics of political democracy that we've enjoyed here for the last 30 years.
Can you track back a bit and tell us what happened in the 2008 Georgia-Russia war? because that does look like a foreboding moment. And it also looks not just for Georgia itself and its politics, but for Putin's turn to imperialism.
Yeah, so 2008, Russia invaded Georgia. It was a very short war. Only lasted maybe a week or so, partially because Georgia is a much weaker and smaller country than Ukraine is, so was therefore not able to put up the same level of resistance. It's a more complicated conflict in some ways because there are several layers. You know, there are conflict was over two regions of Georgia called Abkhazia and South Ossetia, whose a section of the population there effectively wants to align with Russia, not too dissimilar to in the way which Ulster people and Northern Ireland Protestant community prefer to stay in the UK. But it's a complicated conflict in that way. But the kind of short version is that Russia in 2008 saw an opportunity to invade and to establish new facts on the ground. The forces there were responsible for ethnic cleansing, the entire ethnic Georgian population, more or less, of South Ossetia. And you know, previously in Abkhazia were ethnically cleansed. Their villages were burnt to the ground. And that, to this day, they live in temporary accommodation. Russia effectively got away with it. The West got round the table, did a bit of hand-wringing and isn't this nasty, but didn't really do anything, didn't really react to Russia's invasion and was sort of content to let it lie. And the next year, actually, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton embarked upon their reset policy with Russia, which is in terms of having better relations with Russia, not worse relations. And Russia got the signal there that they can get away with invading other countries. They can roll their tanks into neighboring countries, and the West might complain a bit, but won't actually do anything. This is quite contrary to the mainstream consensus on the left in the West, that a part of the problem in Ukraine and in Georgia is that the West and NATO are provoking Russia somehow, that the West, NATO, is this big imperialist power that's marched up to the borders of Russia, and you know, Russia is only reacting and pushing back against this Western expansion. We're quite the opposite. The West has tried its best to avoid provoking Russia. It's not had almost any military force in the east of the NATO bloc until very recently. And in terms of Georgia and Ukraine, it's gone out of its way to avoid giving these countries NATO membership, precisely because it wants to avoid provoking Russia. But the reality is actually it's not Western so-called aggression that is causing this. It's actually, if anything, Western weakness. The fact that Russians have seen that they can get away with things and the West won't react led first to the Crimea invasion in 2014, when little green men turned up and annexed a whole bunch of territory, again to Western inaction, more or less. And now, tragically, with the current war in Ukraine, where Russia thought it could just waltz into Kyiv and the West would just have to follow that up. 2008 was a turning point. Now, that's when Russia learned the lesson. They could get away with committing human rights abuses, ethnic cleansing, invading another country, and the West wouldn't do anything. In fact, you could say even in 1999, Putin personally learned that when he killed thousands of people and slaughtered a good proportion of the population of Chechnya, which obviously is within Russia itself, legally speaking, but wished to have independence and was effectively running its own affairs until 1999.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one argument I've heard about Russia in the 1990s is that really Chechnya shouldn't be seen as an exception, as it generally is, that what you're talking about and what you're kind of seeing in Russia at the time through that 1990s was a series of different kind of very violent conflicts taking place in the transition to a new economy. And part of Putin's success was that he became, in a way, the master of violence or the master of authoritarianism, that said to the criminal gangsters that were taking over large parts of the previously planned economy that you'll be able to have your wealth and power and influence, but I will hold this whole system together in a Bonapartist way. And now, of course, it's easy in the light of the Wagner rebellion of last year, June 2023, to kind of think about Russian imperialism as this kind of fragile coalition of different quasi-military kleptocratic forces, and seeing that also as a means of power projection overseas, whether that's Wagner's activity in Sudan or whether it's intervention in Georgia. I'm just wondering, though, can we nuance some of the analysis around the 2008 war without accepting the idea of this NATO provocation? Because am I right in thinking, Alex, that, you know, the Georgian Dream Party's initial electoral success reflected a kind of backlash against the previous government and the idea that the previous government, or this sentiment in Georgia existed, that the previous government had it gone too far in provoking Russia, and the Georgian dream would pursue a kind of more pragmatic course.
Okay, so I mean, I have to go into the reasons here about why the Georgian dream came to power back in 2012. And yes, absolutely, there was huge dissatisfaction with the government that was in power before that. That was the government of ex-president Mikhail Saakashvili, who was rabidly pro-Western, but also just as much an authoritarian as the current government. And that latter point is what was key to his downfall. So Saakashvili was, I don't want to say he was a kind of Pinochet in Georgia, because Pinochet was perhaps a bit more brutal than Saakashvili. But in the latter years of his government, so after the war, 2008 to 2012, he acted especially repressive ways towards the political opposition and to some extent towards the media and civil society. So a lot of the backlash and the reason that his party lost in 2012 is because a lot of people in Georgia remembered the authoritarian stance of that government. You know, there were a lot of questionable killings that happened during that period. In 2007, what was then the main pro-opposition TV channel was shut down in sort of questionable circumstances. People felt intimidated by that government. And this is why we as progressives and leftists have an advantage over the more mainstream sort of establishment Western dialogue here, because we can say that, yes, Georgians do want to join the EU. They want to split with Russia. And that's kind of a moment of national consensus here in Georgia. But that doesn't mean everyone who's pro-Western is good. And the previous government here combined pro-Western and sort of supposedly pro-EU stances with authoritarian politics. And that latter authoritarian politics is what lost them the government. It was not a backlash against the EU or the West. It was a backlash against that particular government. And that's why in 2012, when this government came to power, it had to wrap itself in the EU flag. This government didn't come back saying, we want to be nicer to Russia. You know, maybe they said that, you know, we'll try and avoid another war with Russia, because obviously we've just been through one at that point. It was a consensus of Georgian politics. And that stayed the case right up until about 2 years ago, when the prime minister who won the election most recently here, Giorgi Gakharia, decided to resign and move into opposition directly from the post of prime minister because of a disagreement between him and the oligarch in charge of the party. And the oligarch in charge of the party basically ordered him as prime minister — that's how the system works here, by the way — to arrest one of the leaders of the opposition. He refused. He said, I'm not going to do this. And that point onwards, this government has turned cryptically towards Russia. And I say cryptically, it's only very recently it's become more obvious. And even now, when Bidzina Ivanishvili, the oligarch, made a big speech about a month ago, he was making statements like the Masons are secretly running the world and all sort of conspiratorial pro-Kremlin nonsense, you know, that there's a global secretive war party trying to make us go to war with Russia and open a second front. And yeah, while he was all saying all this very anti-Western and conspiratorial stuff, he had an EU flag in the background, even now. So even now, the government here is afraid of upsetting the 80% plus of Georgians who want to join the EU. The support of this government absolutely doesn't come from some sort of secret, some sort of yearning for Russia and the Kremlin. It's more fear of that previous government and its authoritarian policies coming back. But obviously now, with the crackdown against the protests, increasing the authoritarian direction this government is taking, the difference between this government and the previous government is becoming a lot more difficult to discern.
And the protests that are happening now, are they driven by the fact that a lot of Georgians are disappointed that they haven't joined the EU? Or, I mean, how big a factor is disappointment?
Well, the direct cause of this wave of protest is that we, in Georgia as a country, it's basically been a moment of national consensus that we want to join the EU, and that it's been assumed that whatever government was in charge, whichever party was in charge, would in good faith deliver on that overwhelming public support for that view. And now suddenly with this Russian law, this foreign agents law, this government is passing a law that makes it impossible for us to join. And that feels like betrayal. And the words that the protesters come up with and the words that are being shouted at politicians from the ruling party are that you are 84 traitors, the 84 MPs who voted for the law. You are effectively the equivalent of what's called the Shulaveri Committee of Bolsheviks in 1921, who were in cahoots with the then Russian Soviet authorities under Lenin and Stalin to invade Georgia and basically end Georgian independence. So between 1918 and 21, it was the first democratic socialist government in the world, actually, that was elected here in those 3 years. And that Menshevik government was brought to an end by the traitors. Those same words are being used now against the current government, that you are basically national traitors.
Well, I just want to drill into the vision of joining the EU in the first place, because it seems a bit far-fetched, right? To join the EU when your ruler holds a third of the nation's wealth, the EU would... You wouldn't meet their democratic standards, would you?
Well, this is the problem. This is part of the problem. Like, up until now, the government was pretending that it was possible. And I think now they've dispensed with most of that pretense. Not completely. They're still promising that Georgia will join the EU by 2030. It's just no one really believes them anymore. Georgia has traditionally in this region been a relatively democratic country, but it's been a very flawed democratic country for a long time. And in terms of passing, in terms of being able to fill the criteria, you know, we're still a way away from that happening. But there's a big difference between a government that in good faith is trying to make it happen and a government that's actively sabotaging it. And that the latter is clearly what's happening here. And I think that's why people are angry. So how realistic is EU membership? Well, that is actually one of the government, you know, lines, but psychologically, you know, we're never going to be accepted. They don't think that the Europeans think we're too poor and too southern and too far east to really be accepted as part of the European family. You know, we're going to be conquered by Russia anyway. Let's try and make the best of that. At least not fight a war on the altar of that. And that's the kind of defeatist rhetoric that the government doesn't say directly, but some of its proxies do disseminate in society to sort of give, rob us of the hope of EU membership. Because this is something I think a lot of the Western left doesn't understand. The EU and EU membership here is not some neoliberal bureaucratic project. It is the only guarantee, the only realistic guarantee of Georgian independence. You know, it's either that or we get conquered by the empire that has been repressing us for 250 years. It's an existential question. Either we're in Europe or we're in Russia. And that's very much the mindset of most people here. So to say that it's not realistic is basically, you know, in a lot of people's minds here, a kind of admission that we are no longer going to exist as an independent country in the full sense. You know, we might have a future similar to that of Belarus, which, you know, is nominally independent, but effectively is pretty much controlled by the Kremlin.
I suppose just to tease that out a bit further, I mean, it does take two to tango, though. And I suppose, like, part of the analysis here is that the European Union has not been keen on further membership expansion for some time. Now Georgia has all of these protests. The Ukraine crisis and Ukraine's membership application has put the question of membership expansion back on the table again, at least for Ukraine, and it is being seriously discussed again. But I suppose my concern was how candidate membership is, like, sometimes imagined and understood, and how the European Union treats candidate member countries is all about conditionality. So countries will sign up to a lot of agreements as a prelude in order to someday in the future be allowed to join. They would be considered in alignment with EU regulation. And the problem that they encounter, and I completely agree, obviously sitting here as another Europe is possible activist, that the European Union is not a neoliberal club. But I think there's some nuance to that, because from the outside, the European Union can be quite neoliberal, right? Once you're in the club, you get lots of benefits, you're treated equally, you have a vote, you get enormous amounts of structural funds from the EU budget that compensate for some of the free market effects of the single market area. But outside the club, you have to sign up to a lot of rules and regulations, and above all, allow basically entry of European goods into your market without much restriction. When you don't get equivalent access to the European market, you fight encounter, even when you have a really deep and comprehensive trade agreement like Ukraine does, you encounter actually soft regulatory barriers to exporting to Europe, usually in the form of not having the right certification for particular products and that kind of thing. Whereas in contrast, European goods in the Ukrainian market are considered automatically compliant with local laws. So I guess my concern is that there's a kind of inequality built into the candidate membership process, which would be okay if candidate members actually joined the European Union. I mean, we have recently had Croatia, for sure. It is possible. But if you're sitting there in limbo for a long time, it creates a bit of a problem. And I'm really interested in what you think about this, Alex, because I know previously, before working at Democratic Security Institute, you were a trade justice campaigner. So this very much aligns with your wider portfolio of interest, this theme of questions.
No, absolutely. And this is exactly the sort of question where we as progressives can have a distinctive and different voice from the mainstream caucus of people who support Ukraine. You know, because it's absolutely, you know, while everyone in Georgia and I think the vast majority of Ukraine and a lot of people in Moldova, the three candidate countries that are kind of on the waiting list in this region to join the EU, there is also the reality that, like, the EU itself in its policies towards these countries isn't always fair. And also, you know, there is this sort of cynicism over the last three decades of these countries trying to get close to the EU. It's like, are you ever actually going to accept us? Are we going to become this permanent grey area in between the EU and Russia where we have to follow all the rules but don't get any say or any of the benefits? And that cynicism is part of what might work in the government's favour here. You know, if people here are convinced that actually, you know, there's no point, we can do everything, but the European Union is too rich and too Western to actually accept us as equal members, then, you know, that changes the calculus in people's minds. You know, we don't want to be forever stuck in this middle situation. And yeah, in terms of trade, Georgia also has a deep and comprehensive, what's called deep and comprehensive free trade area with the EU. But Georgia and Georgian producers and Georgian businesses don't really get to use that very much. The other question, though, is, which slightly kind of nuances that, is that Georgia and this region generally is quite liberal, neoliberal anyway without the EU. It's not as if the EU is forcing neoliberalism on Georgia through its accession process. Otherwise, we'd be living in a socialist Shangri-La. The reality is that both this government and the previous government especially were ideologically very neoliberal. And in fact, if anything, the EU acquis moves us closer to a more progressive position on stuff like labour rights. For example, like, Georgia didn't even have a labour rights legislation until a few years ago. Like, it was basically completely abolished by the previous government. So, you know, we have a minimum wage, which basically doesn't exist. So basic rights like the right to strike and all the rest of it, you know, we're far better off within the fold of EU regulations than the status quo beforehand. So it's absolutely true, everything you say, in the sense that there is a suspicion here. And I feel that as well. I feel that pain that, you know, I sort of have the suspicion that for all the grand speeches and all the declarations of support, ultimately, will France, Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, all this rich club of countries actually put their money where their mouth is and accept Georgia, Ukraine and Moldova into the fold as equal members? Because that's quite expensive. The EU can be quite insular on these things. Or will it do the most convenient thing in the short term and try and keep us within the orbit of the EU without giving us any of the benefits? That is definitely a worry. And I think we as progressives have a really, really important role to play here in kind of pushing back a little bit against the mainstream view of this. It's like, well, wait a minute, are we actually going to do this? Or is this just symbolic? You know, and if we are going to do this, how are we going to support these countries to become EU members in the near future, not push it back to some distant time when it'll be someone else's problem?
So since you've raised Moldova and Ukraine, let's pan out to the international situation. Do you feel like the current protests do capture something about the world we're in and what kind of resistance works against authoritarianism and a new kind of boldness of authoritarianism?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I started, I think, by sort of comparing the situation in 2016 when we were campaigning on the Brexit referendum and now. And I think I stick by that. It feels like in some kind of way, this is part of the same struggle. The kind of the main division in the world is no longer left and right necessarily only. It's also this battle between the two kinds of capitalism, the authoritarian, xenophobic, oligarch capitalist model, represented by Vladimir Putin and, you know, China to some extent, and the neoliberal capitalism that we know all love, all know and hate. So, you know, it's those two forces sort of squaring off against each other. And then we at the left have a very distinctive role here as the third camp, you know, neither Washington nor Moscow, as our predecessors would have put it. But it's a much more difficult situation than in those days, in the sense that there are situations where we have to pick a side to some extent. And the left is sort of split on this question. When we see protest movements, revolutionary movements even sometimes, standing up against imperialism, not the West's, so against the Chinese imperialism, against Russian imperialism, the left feels a bit confused. And, you know, we have, you know, a situation where some people on the left sort of decide that it's Western imperialism that's the priority and that actually these other struggles aren't very important. That's a big mistake. It feels like our part of the left, the Another Europe part of the left, is the part that's saying, actually, no, even if it means a kind of coalition of alliance of convenience with liberals to defeat the kind of fascist authoritarian alternative, then so be it. And I think the other side are the sort of people who are saying, well, actually, we hate neoliberal capitalism so much that we'll team up with almost anyone, including Putin or Xi Jinping, to defeat it. And I feel that's very much something that's encapsulated both that's happening here in Georgia, where both leftists like myself, centrist liberals, and even sort of libertarians who are completely the opposite side of the political spectrum to me, are on the same side opposing this kleptocratic, anti-democratic, authoritarian regime and the Putin model that stands behind it. And I think we in this country understand that much more viscerally than I think people in the West, who the Brexit campaign did bring it out, I think, to some extent. But I think it's very central to the kind of struggle that we're facing.
And Alex, like, you've also provocatively argued, arguably provocatively, you know, the left should get serious about tanks, which I think speaks to this point you've just made about, you know, sometimes you do need to take a side. I mean, you know, in some respects, this was true during the Cold War as well. I mean, you know, most people took a side in Vietnam. They thought that Vietnam should be self-governed and should have self-determination, and that America should get out of Vietnam. That's taking a side. I think there's no particular difference in taking that position and then and saying now that, you know what, Ukraine should be self-governed, that it has a right to resist, and that Russia should get out of Ukraine. No, in some ways there's a commonality of position there. I suppose there's a wider point that you make in that paper that we can put in the notes, where you talk about, you know, hard power and tanks as a element of progressive thinking and strategy. How does that relate to your positionality, as it were, in Georgia, which I think you've alluded to a few times in this chat with this tiny country? I think it's, what, 3 million people in total, the Georgian population, with this enormous, enormous power right on the doorstep, historically the imperial power and contemporaneously so. Of course, in that situation, the idea of self-defense and hard power becomes important for Georgians. Is that your point?
Absolutely. When you're sitting in a comfortable Western European capital, you don't have to worry about the prospect of Russian tanks arriving at your doorstep and depriving your country of independence. It's a luxury that you have in that situation. Obviously, as someone who is also British, I've had that as well. But in Georgia, in Ukraine, you don't have that luxury, nor in Gaza either, obviously. You know, so when you're in a situation where your physical security is potentially under threat, your security as an independent country is under threat, it becomes a lot more existential. And the sort of Western left's default position of sort of, you know, influenced by pacifism, of sort of non-intervention, negotiations, you know, they sound very nice, but actually, you know, it doesn't cut the mustard anymore. You need a progressive stance on how do we defend democracy? How do we defend the independence of countries struggling against colonial or imperial domination with, you know, arms if necessary? You know, and no one likes war. I don't like war. No one else does. And it doesn't make me a warmonger to say that sometimes there's a necessity to defend yourself against far-right imperialist powers. And the problem in this part of the world is there does feel like there's sort of a lack of solidarity a little bit with some of the struggles in Ukraine and Georgia from parts of the Western left, because they see, well, you're fighting the Russians, not the West. That doesn't feel like their struggle. And at worst, at some parts of the left sound like they're sort of almost egging on our oppressors. That's horrible for the local left here, because it solidifies that view in people's minds that, you know, progressive politics and the left supports their enemies and supports their subjugation in the Russian Empire. You know, and that's why one of the reasons why the left is so weak here. The broader point around, you know, why progressives, why the left has to have a position on self-defense, on hard power, is I think a lot of the current passivity on this question dates back to kind of certain historical situations. So Vietnam is one, the Iraq War is another. You know, me, I'm sure both of you marched back in those days against that horrific war that was started by the US and the UK. But ultimately, you know, when you're in this part of the world, there needs to be a different stance. And we can't let the neuroses of past situations, and I don't regret my stance over Iraq, for example. Absolutely, that was the right stance to have then. But this is a different situation. And ultimately, the left has to say to Ukrainians and Georgians, we accept that you have the right to defend yourselves against imperialism, but not just the right, we have a moral obligation as your friends to help you do so. I outline in that essay that I think there is a progressive stance that's different from the liberal stance, it's different from the conservative stance about how do we support struggles of national liberation through hard power. And that's the kind of, why I say, reawaken the Spanish Civil War gene within us. You know, previous generations on the left had a very different stance on hard power and sort of resistance to overwhelming imperialist oppression. And I think the left could actually be a better friend to Ukraine and Georgia and these countries than the establishment. Now, we saw yesterday Biden saying, well, actually, no, NATO membership may not be, you know, something that Ukraine needs. The US position and the Western position is constantly vulnerable to shifting based on what the US sees as its interests. We alluded to in the conversation about the EU, is it in the EU's interest to accept Ukraine and Georgia as members? Maybe it isn't. Maybe the EU does betray us and doesn't let us become members. That's where the left can come in and say, actually, no, we have a responsibility, a solidarity obligation to our neighbours in these countries to support them against oppression and against imperialism.
Okay, so I'm not sure what the question is. I don't want to say what do you think is going to happen, because that everybody knows what's going to happen. I guess the question is, how depressed are you by British politics, both of you?
I'm not that depressed.
Alex?
Luke is always much more optimistic than me, so I'm not surprised, but I'm pretty depressed, yeah. I mean, it's still such a wasted opportunity. And I think that the whole Pfizer, Shaheen scandal, Lloyd Russell Moyle, a lot of our people who were quite good friends of Another Europe Is Possible and are sort of our part of the left have sort of been hurt by this sort of anti-democratic turn within Labour. And, you know, obviously Diane Abbott as well, but she's been reinstated. It feels very depressing that Keir Starmer's Labour Party, even during the Blair era, you know, that Tony Blair may have ignored the left, but at least he let us have a seat at the table in Parliament. And this sort of authoritarian kind of purge is really worrying to me. And it makes me think, if there's no dissent within Labour from the left, it's going to be a very boring and staid political landscape over the next 4 years. Maybe things won't be as terrible objectively in policy terms as it was under the Tories, but it feels like in terms of undoing that damage that we've seen over the last 14 years, not least by Brexit, it feels very disempowering that our voice as the progressive side of the spectrum is going to be very hard to translate into actual action and political change.
Luke, how about you?
Well, I, of course, normatively agree with your critique totally. I just think the left does tend to undersell the social power that it has in society, whether that's the trade unions and their role within Labour, or whether it's letters from, you know, a coterie of extremely influential black celebrities like Lenny Henry and others saying, you know, no, getting rid of Diane Abbott from the list is a line that we think that Labour Party absolutely shouldn't cross, and the success that those interventions had. So I think we're entering into what could be kind of quite an exciting change in British politics, because we're going to be able to win things again, and we have an element of social power that we don't really have when the Conservatives are in office. There are things that we should be celebrating, like the likely death of the Rwanda bill. It's highly likely that not only that the Rwanda bill will not go through, but those that have been detained with the view to deportation to Rwanda will be released. And that will happen very likely, I think, from what I understand, in the first 2 or 3 weeks of a new government. So there's victories that we can have here. And I suppose the context for, you know, my thinking in a way is also looking at the wider European picture. And I mean, when I talk to Europeans, I was at a thing in Croatia, mostly centrist Europeans, really, like intellectuals and think tankers and stuff, over the last weekend. And they are always baffled at how right-wing Britain has become. I mean, they couldn't believe that we didn't already have a public a utility energy company, for instance, and that this was like a headline policy of Labour to bring it in and things. So I see a chance for progress. I think where there will have to be mass movements and mobilisations is over the economic distribution question. I mean, Labour are going into this election tying their hands completely in terms of what they can actually do in government. And yeah, there's going to need to be resistance. But it's 5th of June, we're recording this podcast. Yesterday, the Labour Party put through all of its candidates. There were plenty of left-wingers on the list. There hasn't been a full-scale purge. And so they're now in the election campaign. They can't be removed. So the left is still in the game, comrades. Like, we're still here. We're still fighting.
I mean, I disagree with the analysis, right? I don't think they're trying to purge the left. I think it's purely venal. It was just about getting their people in. And I don't think it's about Keir's people. I think it's a Praetorian guard for the next person. Because if it were Keir, I'm not defending him, he should have been all over it. But if he had been all over it, it would have been a lot smoother. You know, leaders of parties can make a lot of hay with seats of people who are retiring by promising them even glowing tributes and a really soft landing. They don't need to be kicking out Faeza Shaheen. They don't need to be deselecting Ross Lloyd. So I think it's a lot more underhand and a lot more venal, and I'm genuinely worried about who's got the reins in the party.
Totally. I mean, I think the Labour Party is a institutionally corrupt organisation.
What, you do think that or you don't think that?
I do think that.
Okay, what do you think, Alex? Do you think it's institutionally corrupt from, like, speaking from Georgia?
I mean, the whole point is that that sort of shady authoritarian, suddenly a candidate gets disappeared overnight, is just the sort of politics we're out in the streets to try and stop. So when it's, when I see it coming from the political party that I purportedly support, it does not appeal to me at all, and it makes me very worried. And I knew, obviously, I had very low expectations of the quality of Labour Party democracy anyway, but this was shocking even to me. You know, the fact that Lloyd can just get a letter out of the blue, that Faeza, you know, was just, you know, again, for liking a tweet by a mainstream US comedian. I mean, it's absolutely Orwellian. I think it's quite worrying. And yeah, maybe it hasn't translated into a full purge, but that's not for... I think if they could have got away with that, I think they would have done. I think the backlash over Diane Abbott especially has stymied a worse counter-reaction. But I think... My question, I think, to both of you, and especially Luke, given your annoying optimism, but I hope you're right at the same time, is that, you know, what are you actually looking forward to in policy terms from this Labour government? Because I struggle outside of the stuff around the energy sector. And, you know, I sort of have this sort of quiet faith that something will happen over housing because it's so electorally important to Labour. But aside from that, I'm really struggling to find anything in policy terms to get excited about. You know, primarily because of that fiscal handcuffs problem that you've been talking about, but also just in basically every way. I mean, at least under Blair, we had the minimum wage to look forward to. We had the huge Gordon Brown redistribution of wealth that happened through tax credits. I just don't see where that kind of stuff is going to come from. And this is the Blair era we're talking about. It's quite a low bar for excitement, right? I just don't even see that level of policy change coming. But I hope I'm wrong. You know, I hope you're right.
Well, I suppose my way into that question is it's been fashionable, I think, to reevaluate the Blair era in recent years, including among the left, to think about working tax credits, the minimum wage, devolution, to think about that coterie of achievements, big funding for the NHS, etc., in more positive terms than the left thought about it at the time. I mean, I push back on that a bit, to be honest. I mean, I'm nearly middle-aged now. I remember the Blair years. It was fanatically right-wing in its discourse and language about politics. It had this idea that the UK, or it was in the interest of everyone to become middle class. It was very different in that sense from the third way, how it was applied in Gerhard Schroeder's Germany, because in Germany, there was always this idea, look, we know it's bad, but you've just got to do this stuff because we need to build a more competitive economy, but we know it's bad and we're very sorry. Blair actually constructed an almost Thatcherite idea of individualism, that this was all wonderful and in everyone's interest to embrace deindustrialization and take it further and so on and so forth. So I think the whole framing and narrative of Starmerism is actually quite different. Class is back. It has resonances with the Ed Miliband leadership in that sense of a kind of restoring an idea of class. And it also has adopted a lot of this language from the Biden administration around secure economics. Now, it's not that the individuals, the coterie of corrupt people, the venal types that Zoe was talking about, have become more progressive. Rather, what's happened is that the paradigm has moved globally away from neoliberalism. And what seemed to be pragmatic in the early 2000s is no longer pragmatic today. It's no longer a pragmatic thing to say, okay, we're going to take private finance initiative even further into public services, or privatization even further into public services. We're going to marketize the NHS to a much greater degree than previously. All of the things that I think should be associated with the Blair government are no longer pragmatic politics in 2024. So my source of hope really is, if you want to fix things, whether that's Thames Water that's likely to be renationalised, whether that's universities that will collapse without an injection of government money. If you want to fix stuff, you have to pivot to the left. So it's not individual policies, though some of the framing I think is significant. It's more this kind of paradigm shift that presents an opportunity for left pressure, because the whole paradigm has largely moved in our direction. And I think that's what makes the kind of corruption of the right wing of the Labour Party even worse or interesting in a way, is that they actually have no ideas. It's not like the Blair era where they were coming up with ideas and driving them forward. They're really empty of ideas. And what they're left with is this kind of factional authoritarianism.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I'm positive about, and I don't know whether I'm right about this, is that I've never rated Rachel Reeves especially, but a lot of people I do rate do think that her Mays lecture had the beginning of at least thinking seriously about having an industrial policy in a way that the Labour Party hadn't really had since 2001. So if that's true, then that's good.
And so they do have an industrial policy to some degree, I think you're right. But again, I think they're just kind of riding on the coattails of history in that sense. So I don't know, I'm probably exaggerating my own argument as a counteraction to wider sentiments among progressives. But I do think there's stuff to look forward to.
It sounds like your argument is more the winds of change are blowing in our direction, but Keir Starmer is marginally less likely to resist them than the Tories. It's a bit thin rule, but I'll take it.